This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect our office's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in these three fields, all in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on the current trends and issues facing the Garden State. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hi, my name is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. On May 15th, our office held its second annual domestic terrorism conference, where we brought together law enforcement, intelligence, and academic professionals to discuss the topic of domestic terrorism and its presence in our communities across the country and internationally. The series of podcasts you're about to hear are interviews with many of those featured speakers who were there that day. We hope you find them interesting and as informative as we did.
Hello. Thank you for tuning into Intelligence Unclassified. What you're about to listen to is part one of a two-part series discussing a former white supremacist journey throughout the movement. Part one will take a look at his indoctrination and what eventually led him to leave and speak out against hate. This is his story.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Matthew Cruz with the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. I'm an intelligence analyst, and I'm here today with my coworker, Kimberly Brown. So we have our special guest today, Frank Meek. Frank Meek is a former recruiter for the neo-Nazi movement and a leader of a skinhead gang. He joined the movement in his early teens, and by 17, Frank was hosting a cable access show called The Reich to recruit more people into the neo-Nazi movement. By 18, he was doing hard time in an Illinois prison. He has written a memoir of his time as an extremist and a book titled Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead, and then the film American History X was loosely based on Frank's life. Frank now speaks about tolerance and diversity and has partnered with the Philadelphia Flyers to launch a hate prevention program called Harmony Through Hockey. Frank, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, no, thanks for having me. Thanks for bringing me to Jersey.
Of course. Glad to have you back here. Yes. So we'll get started right with the question. So Frank, can you tell me, how did you first become involved with the white supremacist movement?
I had a cousin that was involved, you know, and I grew up in the city. I grew up in Philadelphia, and I had to change schools in the middle of the year. I was 13, and I changed schools from a pretty diverse school to an all-black school and up in like Southwest West Philly, like the Fresh Prince area. So I went up there and I had to go to school, and that's where I started to kind of really notice race, because I was kind of getting jumped and there was a lot of fights in there all at our school. And that year I got to go up to my cousin's house after I got done school there. I was living in my dad's neighborhood in Southwest Philly. I went up to my cousin's house up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, with all these Amish people. And my cousin was involved in this group, this skinhead group. And all these older skinheads used to always hang out at his house. And then my aunt and uncle, they weren't into that stuff, but they kind of like, they moved their kids out of Philly, so they thought their kids were going through a phase. So they were just letting them go, gradually go through their phases. Well, this phase was something that really latched on to me, because when I would hang out with these older neo-Nazi guys, going on 14 years old, and these big guys, I thought they were so cool, but they thought I was cool because I was from the city. So they would always talk to me about what's it really like growing up around black people. Like, they really couldn't fathom I see black people every day, because they see Amish people every day. Well, to me, I had a very horrible home life. Both parents were drug addicts and alcoholics. Finally, someone was paying attention to me. And that was my first gravitation towards this group, when they started using words that, they're using the N-word, or, talking about Jews, which I didn't know anything about Jews. But I just remember it was very interesting to me. It seemed enlightening at the time.
So after that, when you went back to Philadelphia from there, what was it like leaving Philadelphia as a normal kid there, going to Lancaster and coming back almost involved with the group right there?
When I got out of the Lancaster area, and I'm now becoming a skinhead, I actually moved back to my mom's neighborhood again, and I went to high school. Well, for one, I come back with this new image. People kind of look at me kind of differently. My neighborhood was kind of a tough Irish Catholic neighborhood. You learn how to fight, and you're either bullied or you're the bully, that type of neighborhood. And now I was kind of the bully. Maybe the year before, I was never really bullied that much, because I had a bunch of big cousins in the neighborhood, so it's always a good thing. But my first week at school, in high school, I get caught with a gun at school, which back then that wasn't a big deal. They make the news. Everyone had guns at school. So I got caught with a gun at school and I got arrested. And that even added to my image even more. So now everyone's like this new skinhead kid, And I was going around my neighborhood, because again, I go over in this all Irish neighborhood, and I'm talking to these people about being proud to be white and, come join this group. And all these neighborhood kids started to kind of like it and thought it was interesting. So it's kind of easy pickings to really start my recruiting them. at 14. You know, like I just made this big crew around me, and I started bringing all these suburban kids down to the city. It's a perfect storm, as they say sometimes. Hate that analogy, but it was. I mean, I had suburban kids and neighborhood kids that were just making this crew. I mean, we got up to about maybe 40 deep real quick and made a name for ourselves.
So as a recruiter for the group, a few questions based off that. So what methods did you employ when you were looking for that? You said your group reached about 40 its max point. And what exactly made a good recruit?
First thing, and I knew this just for myself. If I heard a kid say, hey, I have to be home every day at 5 o'clock, man. I have to eat dinner. My parents say I have to be home at 5 o'clock. And that kid was strictly home at 5 o'clock. I knew he was going to be a hard recruit. But if a kid was like, they had a bad home life in that way. Most teenagers, you know, you think everything's so horrible, but I kind of was able to read if a kid was really that way or not. And I just knew if a kid was kind of rebelling from his home and he didn't have respect for his parents and maybe they didn't have respect for him, I knew he was an easy recruit. So parenting is, I hate to put everything back on the parents, but parenting is a huge issue. People always say, what would have stopped me from becoming part of this group in the first place? Good parenting. If I would have respected my parents and my parents respected me, and I don't mean, you know, I don't mean like respect, like as in they let me get away with everything, but I mean, just had the decency enough to like pay for my schooling or go show up my sporting events because my parents didn't do that stuff. I would have not gotten into this group flat out. Wouldn't have got into it.
So from joining the skinhead movement and then eventually creating a group of your own, what were you expecting the outcome to end up being in the long run? Where you see yourself in 5 years from the start point to 10 years and so on?
You know, back then I couldn't even imagine, but I know that my main goal always and what we always talked about was a race war. We teamed up with the militias, we would team up with the Klan, we would team up with any group that somewhat had a same similar goal as ours. Sometimes the militias wouldn't call it a race war, but when we say the word race war, I learned quickly that even at 15, you know, when I talk about a race war, I didn't mean black versus white in this country. We meant like the white groups fight the federal government, black groups fight the federal government, and then we split the country up. That was our plan. You know, there have been people that have tried to do this. And then there's a book called Blood in the Face. And in the middle of Blood in the Face is the actual map that Louis Farrakhan, Richard Butler, all the people, the extremist groups, black and white, got together and kind of said, here's the map. Here's what we want. Here's what you want. And we make show or how we're going to split the country up. So that was our final goal.
So in your book, The Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead, you talk about the first time your group, you label it Strike Force, correct?
Strike Force was the name of the group. That was our main group, first one.
In the group, you said, you told you the story when you first went out as a group and you attacked the first person. You gave it a specific name. What was the name?
Terror Squad.
Terror Squad, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you said the Terror Squad went out. What was it like when you did your first, went out to go and find kids to beat up and go from there? What was that like?
You know, you got to remember, and I don't know if I'm trying to justify any of this, but you got to remember I'm a broken human being. And most of the people in my group are broken. And we didn't get camaraderie. And every group needs camaraderie. I mean, that's what holds your group together. Our camaraderie wasn't going out and shooting basketballs or, you know, hockey pucks. It was fighting. And so that was some of our camaraderie at nights was what we did to people or what people did to us. I mean, we got jumped all the time, too. You know, people don't like the neo-Nazis neither, you know. But we definitely went looking for trouble. So the first nights we did that, I remember we were getting this one guy. He was a college guy. And as we're beating on him, it was going too far. And I remember looking down at him for a split second and thinking, my uncle at the time was in college, and I really loved my uncle. Really looked up to him. And so I remember for a split second thinking, like, this could be my uncle. Like having that moment of sympathy and empathy, you know. And real quickly someone said, oh, cops are coming, you know, or something. And so it snapped me back into what we were doing. I was like, you know, got out there and everyone's giving each other high fives. We're running down the street. And it was one of those glimpses of moments in your life where you're like, I had it again. See, when you join these groups, you don't lose your empathy and sympathy and compassion. You don't lose them. This is a quote from another great former in Canada. I didn't lose it. I gave it up for acceptance. I gave it all away for acceptance into this group. I gave up my empathy. I gave up my compassion for other human beings because this bonding of this group was so overwhelming to me.
That feeling that you had when you were looking over the kid, did that ever come back later on in, you know, a few years after?
Oh, yeah. Haunted the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that haunted the hell out of me. Not while I was in the movement, but years later when I had to kind of make my amends to the world. I remember that moment. That was one of them moments in my head that always stuck, like, took it too far. Mm-hmm. Took it too far. Shouldn't have happened at all, but definitely took it too far.
So fast forwarding, so you spent, it was 3 years in an Illinois prison?
Just a year and some change on that 3 year bit, yeah.
Okay, so what happened that made you eventually get sentenced and have to go there?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that this morning when we were walking in and you just see all the law enforcement and you know, I mean, I do work with law enforcement all the time now, like a lot of these lectures and stuff like that. So it's just funny when you walk into these places. I always remember the day I'd been in and out of juvie as a skinhead, Philly juvie, Chicago, all around that area. And I remember the day they're walking me in. They arrested me in my TV show. I was doing the next taping of my TV show on this kidnapping charge. And they bring me in. And I remember there was a yellow line that when you walked into this county jail, you walked on the yellow line, you go to the left when you're juvenile, and you go to the right if you're an adult. And I just remember that they didn't make the left, you know. We kept on walking. I was 17 years old. And they're like, no, you're charging an adult this time. You, like, you did it too much this time. So I remember when they charged me with aggravated assault. Aggravated unlawful restraint was the final. Well, they first had a kidnapping charge. Then it turned to aggravated unlawful restraint, which basically we didn't leave but a person leave that place we had them trapped at. But we didn't bring him to that place, which would save me from a 15-year bid, is that we kind of got him to come to us. So anyway, when they gave me the aggravated unlawful restraint and they sent me up to the prison, I remember my second prison I get transferred to is with John Wayne Gacy. He's there. And this dude's like the serial killer who killed 17, 18-year-old boys, 34 of them, as they know of, buried them under his house in Chicago. And I remember they brought me there, and the guards will always make sure if they find out you're young to say to you, we're going to put you in a cell with John Wayne Gacy. And I was such a little jerk at the time. This was always running my mouth. And so when they take me off the bus, the guard says that to me, I could put you in John Wayne Gacy. And I was like, good, do it. You know, I'm 17-year-old, little smart, you know, smart mouth. I said, put me in there with him. I'll kill him. And I probably would have. He's an old dude, old at the time. So anyway, they take me in. The Aryans right away knew who I was, who I had been, because I have my TV show. So it was like a little celebrity to a lot of those guys. A lot of the Aryans in prison are guys who join these gangs once they're in prison. You know, there might be bikers. They might be affiliated with bikers or some other type of groups like that, but they're not very active in the Aryan movement. So you get to prison. You're like, whoa, we're outnumbered. We got to join, you know. So when I got there, here was this guy. I had a big swastika on my neck. I got tattoos all over my head. I'm hosting a TV show. All these guys know all this stuff. I was like a little celebrity to them. Like their job, they took it as an honor, and their job was to protect me. And that's not bad. It's not a bad place to have that type of honor, you know? So I was like, good for you. So, and they did. They took it very serious. And it was, I turned 18 about 6 months into my bit. And I remember I used to play a lot of ball. And it's, you know, this is where I started to change a little bit. I started playing football again. I was always an athlete. I was always a star athlete. Every place I ever won, school-wise or neighborhood-wise, I was always the star athlete in my neighborhood, even with the swastika on my neck and Made in Philly tattooed on my head. So I started playing basketball with some of the brothers from Chicago. Because the white dudes kind of sucked. And I don't mean that stereotypically. I mean, like, I played basketball with bikers. And as Chris Rock said, you gotta let double dribbling go. You let traveling go because they don't know how to play. And I knew how to play. And so I wanted to play with dudes who knew how to play. Same thing with football. And I started playing a lot of football in there. And mostly played with, some of the brothers from Chicago and East St. Louis. And it just kind of became cool with me. You know, you start playing football. I'll never forget the moment. I hate to go along with this, but so when I first joined the football team and I started showing up on Sundays or whatever day we had it was, I think it was Saturdays actually. Saturday afternoons, we all go play football. It was a neutral day in the yard. No gang affiliations had to matter. You could just go play. So we'd all show up and play, and we always played the other cell blocks. And I was mainly the only white kid. And I get the football the first time and no one's blocking for me, which I knew they weren't going to. But I run it back anyway because I'm just good. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I'm fast and I'm good. I'm short. And I could make spin moves like a mofo. So I make these spin moves and I run all the way back. And then after the next couple of weeks, I noticed I'd always get cheap shotted a lot. I got cheap shotted probably every play. When we have whistles, which is guys say, all right, play's over. I'd always get cheap shotted. And no one ever do anything about it. No one ever helped me. Finally, the third week, kid comes and lays me out way after play was over. And all these dudes on my team start pushing the dude. So it was like these black dudes fighting this other black dude because he cheap shotted me. You know, and I remember I was looking up at them. I was like, all right, these guys are my team, you know? And I remember, after that, man, just giving them 100%, all the time. And I always talk to my kids, what I do now is I coach hockey, about, standing up for one another, especially in hockey. You got to stand up for one another. And I always say, you don't understand me going up to a guy who made a mistake and yelling at him if he's my teammate. I ain't going to get the 100% out of him. If I stand up for him, he's going to give his all every play because he's like, these guys are on my back. So, anyway, it was one of them moments in my life where I was like, these guys got my back. It's cool, so.
So was that experience in prison what kind of pushed you away from the movement and the ideas of a skinhead?
It definitely did. It was one of the moments where everyone just became human, no matter how hardcore, no matter how tough. When you're in prison, you've all been in a holding cell where you had to drop a deuce in front of everybody else. You know what I mean? No matter how hardcore you are, no matter how tough you are, you had to drop a deuce in front of, you know, it's one of them things that's very equalizing, you know, in a way. Now, the system, I don't believe, is equalizing, but once you're in there, it's equalizing. I just remember being like, no matter what, at the end of the day, we all kind of had the same thing. Like, the younger guys in prison, we all have girls on the outside. You try to stay with your girl, but you don't stay with, you know, it's the hardest time you can do in the world is when you have a girlfriend on the outside or a wife. And all the older inmates know that. So, like, as soon as they get a 10-year bit, they're like, let's get a divorce. I don't want to, you know, because I just don't want to think about you. So, you know, just keep going along and do your thing. And I remember all of us young guys would always talk about girls. But if you talk to the older inmates, no matter what color you are, you're always going to talk to your same color inmates because they're still your crew. They always say bad things about your girl. Oh, your girl's doing this while you're in here. You don't want to hear that stuff. You know, you're trying to do time. You're trying to get out, trying to get back with your girl. So I stopped talking to them guys about my intimate part of my life, my own errands. But I noticed the guys on the football team every day or basketball, we always talked about girls because we were all 16, 17, 18-year-old guys in there at the adult prison. And we'd always talk about girls. And we always say the same things that, like, we'd like to hear. Like, G'd be like, yeah, my girl. I'm like, oh, your girl's going to wait for you. No one said that to us. You know what I mean? Everybody'd be like, oh, your girl ain't going to wait for you. She's going to be with your friend, you know, whatever. And I remember, like, looking forward to that time every day. Just look forward to it. Because I felt good. I felt normal. I felt like I was talking about a girl. You know, we talk about what we did with them. You know, I had a baby on the way. Tony had a baby on the way. Gio, I think, already had a kid. Joe already had a kid. So we don't just talk about that stuff. It was cool. It was just cool.
So once your time in prison was ending, what was it like getting out and then trying to go back into the movement?
You know, when I got out of the movement, when I got out of prison, I wasn't out of the movement. I didn't leave. It's, you know, American History X, you know, the guy leave the movement in prison. You don't do that stuff. That's just not, it's not sane. It's not a sane thing to do. And I didn't think I was going to leave the movement anyway. What was going on in prison was going on in prison. It's behind the walls. It's not real life, so we say. So when I got out of prison, I went right back to my group. That's what I knew. Plus, my ex-girlfriend who did leave me, like the older inmates did say, they were right. But she left me and we had a daughter and she really kind of didn't want me to be around. I was just getting out of prison. I'm a thug. I'm a criminal. I'm still violently probably racist at the time. I can only speak for what she had said to me later on. So I moved back to Philly. And when I moved back to Philly, I take over my old crew. So I went from Springfield, Illinois to Philly. And my crew is gigantic in Philly. I mean, it's at the time it was, I don't know, maybe 100 deep, something like that, with you know, supporters. And I go back and I take over the group again. My cousin was the head now. So now I go back and I'm now the head. I come home again. And I hate to use this as a thing, but I came home like a little celebrity to them. I was in prison. I kidnapped a rival. You know, I did my time. I didn't snitch. So when I came home, I was respected, I guess, and that tweaked my ego. And that's what you all got to know, that when you deal with people like me and people in gangs and in terrorist groups, we're all the same makeup across the board, from Pakistan to the South Side of Chicago, don't matter, Pennsylvania. We're all egomaniacs with no self-esteem. We are just dangerous, dangerous human beings when you're like that. When I go back to Philly, I'm doing it, when I get back to my group, I remember there was times I'd be sitting in meetings, when we would have meetings and guys would be going on a racist ramble. And I think that's not true. Like, this is not true. Like, that's G was nothing like that at all. In fact, I'd rather hang out with G than most of you losers. You know, not the people, everyone in the movement, you losers, I'm going to say, but the group I was hanging with were some losers. And I was just thinking, like, that's not true. But I was like, I got to keep believing this because you know why? I had seniority. I had so much seniority. Like, you don't want to lose your seniority. I gained that seniority. I earned it. And I remember for a while there, like, just wanting to be part of the group. Plus, I still get hate to Jews. I didn't know anything about Jews, so there was no Jews in prison. So I still kind of had this one hate, and that was my main hatred by that time anyways, was the Jews. So I was like, you know what, I'll just keep hating the Jews. I'll keep my other racist beliefs to myself, but I'll still preach against the Jews, you know, because that's still making me part of what I am and my seniority. But by the end, man, I was just banging my head against the wall to believe something. When you start to know that something you believe for so long isn't true, it's hard. You know, like people to believe the Cowboys are the greatest. Cowboys aren't the greatest NFL team. They're just not. And I know it's hard for them to admit, but I had to admit that my team was wrong. And it was really hard because it was all my friends. It was all my supporters. Everything I knew for the last 6 years was all wrapped up in this.
So what was it like when you finally decided to leave? What pushed you to that point? And once you did leave, what was that like for your group and all your friends and family?
One of the things I always got to make sure people, I wasn't an interrogation or room changer. I wasn't the guy that was in trouble and was like, okay, I'm done. I didn't mean it. You know, I'm really just a good guy and I hang out with bad guys, you know. I was the bad guy and I know that. And I know that when people say, oh, my kid hung out with the wrong crew, I was the wrong crew. I wasn't the kid that hung out with the wrong crew. But when I was getting out of this, I remember that I had what I call my karma score with the world, like credit score. But I just knew that my karma score was really bad. really bad. And there was so much bad that was going to come back on me that not even my children could pay off my debt. I really thought that. So I just knew that, like, I had to change something. Something had to change. There was people in my family and my life who did not want to be around me anymore because I talked nothing but criminal, racist, thuggish stuff. And they didn't want to be around me anymore. And these were good people. So I had to think, like, why and what am I doing in life? So the last thing that was, like, the final straw was, so I had all these beliefs again. And again, I'm starting to believe that everyone is equal except for the Jews. Well, whatever higher power you believe in, that higher power puts people in your life. And so I had no job prospects. I have a swastika on my neck with aggravated kidnapping on my record already. It's not people skills. I'm not going anywhere, you know? This Jewish guy gives me a job carrying in and out antique furniture in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, just for the weekend, $100 a day, just for one 3-day weekend. And so I go and I work for him. And at the end of the weekend, he was very, and people would get mad at this, but it's the truth. Keith was, if you had to write a stereotypical story of a Jewish man, if I had to draw it up, Keith is it. He said, ugh, he was a Jewish guy. And he gives me this job. And I made like $600 in tips alone. I mean, tons of money in tips. And I know he knew that. So I thought he wasn't going to pay me my $100, the $300 he owed me, $100 a day. And he walks up to me on Sunday night. He's like, I owe you money. Now I'd already planned out this fight with him. Like, you know, we all do that. We plan out a fight with somebody. He's going to say this and I'm going to say that. Well, he came up to me. He's like, I owe you money. I'm like, yeah, you do. You know, waiting to fight with him. And he says, how much? I said, $300. He goes, oh yeah, $100 a day. I'm like, yep. Waiting for him to want to fight with me. And he goes, pulls out this wad of money. He goes, here you go. 1, 2, 3. Here you go. He goes, you know what, man? You're a really good worker. Here's an extra $100. I thought, you son of a gun. Like, I had this fight waiting, you know, ready to go. And then he asked me, he said, hey, let me give you a ride back to your neighborhood. I'll give you a ride back home if you want one. I said, sure. So he gives me a ride from Cherry Hill back to South Philly. And in that time, he says, hey, what do you do for a living? And I point to this swastika on my neck. And I said, I don't do anything. He said, why don't you come work for me? And I went and worked for this Jewish man who, you know, he wasn't religiously Jewish, but he was ethnically, he was Jewish. And he gives me this full-time job where he paid me very well, taught me all about the antique business. We used to drive up in this area, up in North Jersey, all the time because we used to come up here to pick up furniture and then drive back down to the Philly warehouses. And I used to drive with him, man, every day, like almost every day. I go with him, pick up furniture. And he was just a good man in my life. Became one of them people that everyone has in your life that's just kind of a mentor. You know, we all need mentors. And he's kind of became this mentor for about 6 months. I was still part of the neo-Nazis because he's just one Jewish man. You know, he's just one. And one day, man, he just laid it out for me how intelligent I was and how smart I was and how much he thought I was a great human being. And as we're driving home, actually from up here, up from North Jersey, I remember just looking over at him like just in awe of him. And I had my neo-Nazi boots on that day. And as we're driving, I just said, as we're talking, I was kind of embarrassed of my beliefs for the first time. I was truly like embarrassed because I really held this guy in high regards. And he's telling me about how I'm so smart and that stuff isn't. But he wasn't like preachy. He was just talking. And he had said that I was one of the most smartest people he had ever met. And it was just like, wow. Like, wow. It was just one of the moments where I was just like, how dumb can I be? I'm tired of beating my head against the wall. So I just made the kind of claim, not to him, but that day I got out of the truck. He dropped me off. Went home. And I just took off my neo-Nazi boots. Never put them back on. It was just like, I'm just done. It was a consistent, everyday training of my brain. I had to. For the next year, if I really was going to be out of this, I had to be out of it. You know, like I drive down South Philly and I see a black dude selling food stamps because back then they sold paper food stamps. 50 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar. And I say, see, that's what I'm talking about. I'm going to be like, wait a minute, my mom does that. She just does it out of her house. Like, because he does it on a street corner. My mom does it out of the house. We're less or better than her. Or an Asian woman like cut me off, you know, the stereotypes. I say, oh, yeah, Asian. And I go, wait a minute, my aunt hit a cow this year. She actually hit a cow. She really did. My aunt hit a cow. Like, how do you hit a cow? They're not deer. They don't jump in your freaking way. It's there. It was already there when she got there and she hit it. So like, I just started like all those types of things where I always could put what someone else done and put it with someone I knew. Didn't matter what race, color, creed you were. So that's how I kind of started to train my brain to where that was 25 years ago. You know, to where now it doesn't, you know, I'm not colorblind. I don't like that saying. But, I mean, I understand that there's color and there's race in this country and there's issues we have. We have to deal with them. But I don't hold anyone in any different regards because of the color of their skin. Definitely not. There's people that are mentors in my life that I don't have black friends or Jewish friends. I have mentors in my life that teach me how to be a man, who teach me how to be a father, who aren't white people. So that's how I live my life.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. So what was it like for your family, both those in the movement and out, and then your group itself when you finally left?
So most of my family was happy when I got out, but it wasn't like, it wasn't right away, like the doors were opening. It was, you know, I had to prove myself, you know, and I get that. And they weren't telling me that to prove myself. I just know my family. Like, so that was great on all my uncles and aunts and my cousins that were still involved. There's still one that doesn't talk to me at all. Another one who was the one that got me into it. He's kind of, you know, he's kind of a cool guy. He's kind of gotten out of things. I'm sure he still has some beliefs, but we can talk to each other civilly and be around each other. And he's a good dad. And so, you know, I don't hold any ill will towards him at any way. I mean, most of my life and my family were just starting to come together. I noticed the more I believed in that, you know, we're all equal or whatever. I don't want to put it that way because it sounds too hippie-ish. But the more I started to know that if I lived my life the right way, I held the door for no matter what color person. I held the door for them and I said, thank you. And I said, please. I noticed my life worked out better than if I had anger, hatred, and violence. My life worked out better. I didn't have feelings inside me that my gut was eating me up that I did when I was 16, 17 years old. When I was 16, 17 years old, I woke up in the morning. My first thought was, why do they got BET? Why don't we have white entertainment television? You know, now I know because it's a horrible acronym and it'd probably be more of a porno network, but whatever. I didn't want to have to wake up every morning and fight this battle that doesn't need to be fought because there's just so much other real issues. And there's starving children. There's other issues that we should all be dedicating our time to than separating ourselves because of race. Because for me to judge someone on the race and the color of their skin is so asinine to me now. It makes me the loser right away in the situation because I'm already judged you and I don't know who you are, what you've done. I'm already lost that situation. I've already lost that battle. And it just works. It just works in the right way. So my family started to see that I was different. And I started to work towards different things. And obviously the movement was not happy with me. They hated me. They jumped me. They jumped me at Joe Rowan's funeral, which was, he was like this big head legendary skinhead in Pennsylvania. He's one of my great friends. I mean, when I had to go on the run, he helped me. He was one that physically helped me get on the run when I was wanted by law enforcement back when I was in the movement. Just great friend. And I go to the funeral because I know his mom, I know his dad. And they jumped me, you know, right outside the funeral. And I knew that. And I was, once that happened too, that even separated me more because I started to hate skinheads and I hate the neo-Nazis. And I hate the white supremacist movement. So I kind of right away had this attitude towards against it, which I don't today. I don't have my, you know, the belief I might, but person, I don't at all. But after the Oklahoma City bombing is where it started to really change with me from hiding who I was to an activist. And that's when I turned to law enforcement then.
So was it after that you started speaking out against this more formally?
Yes. And as you can understand, I ain't got the most intelligent dialect here. I'm a South Philly welfare kid, grew up very poor, and I never even went to high school. I got arrested at high school for 1 week, and I never went back. I never went back to school at all, ever. So to tell you that like I was going to speak out against this, I never even heard of really professional speakers or public speakers. I mean, at my school, when I grew up, we had two assemblies every year. One guy came in and said, stop robbing the trains, because we had a little Comrade train yard going by, and they'd come and show us pictures of guys with their legs cut off, you know. Stop robbing the trains. And we go, we know that guy. You know, or the guy coming in, PGW, Philadelphia Gas Works, coming in, blow a house up in front of us. If you smell gas, get out. That was our assemblies in school. When someone first asked me after a year being out of this, someone said, will you go speak to these kids about your experience? And I was like, okay. No message. You know, still lived in the mess. There's a mess. You either live in a mess or you live in a message. And I still was kind of in the mess. And I went and I destroyed these children. Like, I scarred the crap out of them. I didn't know what the hell I was saying. I didn't know what I was doing. I just talked about all the violence I'd done and how bad I felt. And don't do that. Like, I didn't know how to say the message. And I remember, like, man, there was definitely kids that had to go to therapy. And I just felt so bad. And this one guy was like, no, you did really good. He goes, and then they asked me to speak again. And they asked me to speak to these adults. And I went and talked to these adults. And then they asked me to speak more to kids. It was like this whole big thing that rolled. And you know, I did this for about 6 years and I didn't ask for a dime. I didn't even know. I didn't even know I should ask for it. I thought I just had to pay my penance back to the world. Like, I just did this. And then I got really good at it, I guess. And I'm good at relaying my message and keeping it entertaining. But my life had just changed dramatically. I mean, I met the right people in my life and people in my life who supported me for the right reasons. I wasn't getting accolades. See, all the violence we talk about in the movement, I got accolades all the time. Attaboy, Frankie. Good job down in Philly. You guys are really tearing it up down there. The people in my life now, if they heard I did that stuff or if I did it now, you know, they wouldn't give me accolades. They would say, what the hell are you doing? That's not how you become a man. That's not how you become a father. That's not how you become a proper human being on this planet, by doing those actions. And that's what I needed to surround myself with. And the more I got with those people, the more my life got better. And that's what you want in the end. It's just your life to be better.
So aside from the speaking, do you do any other foundations or work that gets people out of those types of situations into better ones where you can learn and train?
Absolutely. I have to pay it back. You always have to pay it back. And one of the main things I do is I'm part of a group called Life After Hate. Life After Hate is all kind of the heads of the group back in the day who are now out of the movement. And mostly a lot of us have had spiritual or very mental foundation changes to our life. And so we started to come together. We came together in Dublin, Ireland, and we said, let's make this group where we can help the next guy getting out. So, and it's kind of my job in kind of a way, is, and I've always been doing this, is to help the next guy. It's basically like AA. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, and I'll tell you there's a little trick. The 12 steps, the 12-step program, NA, AA, all the A's. The 12 steps is a trick in the fact that all it does is it reteaches you empathy. So that in step 12, you help the next guy coming in the door. That's the only payment you got to get back to in those groups. You don't have to give money. You can even give him a dollar if you want. But your job to pay the group back is to help the next guy that comes in the door that has the same story as you, similar story, whatever. It's all about empathy. And that's what my whole life is about now, is empathy. If I can find empathy in you, I cannot hate you. I can never hate you because we have either similar pain somewhere that I share with you or coming out of pain. So Life After Hate was formed. It's a great group. It's, we're very informative. You know, anyone needs help in any way. You know, people that are in school doing research, we help people to, you know, law enforcement, but we don't snitch. We just kind of, if you need information on why people are being the way they are, we help you. But then the other thing I do, and it's been dear to my heart for a long time, it's one of my first things I ever started, was with the Philadelphia Flyers. I started this group called Harmony Through Hockey, where the Philadelphia Flyers gave me hockey equipment and said, go into North Philly, find some black kids and play hockey. And so we did that. And then we mixed it black-white. Now it's called the Ed Snyder Foundation. And it's helped over like 8,000 kids play hockey that would never have had the chance to play. I just happen to do that in Iowa, where I'm at now. And I do it through roller hockey and ice hockey. And that's my job. I mean, not just Harmony Through Hockey. I coach a team called the Des Moines Explosion, which is, I'm just going to say, you know, 3-time national champ. So maybe I'm doing something right, or I'm working with the right people. But yeah, so I coach hockey. That's my other main job. And I teach life lessons through hockey. All the kids, your kid joining my hockey program, it doesn't have to be Harmony Through Hockey. It could just be a hockey team that I'd run. Your kid's going to learn about humility, about the best teammates you could be is a person that has humility in their life. Because humility is, I don't think less of myself. See, I go back to my own self all the time. I don't think less of myself, but I think about myself less. And I put my team first. And if I could do that in the world, it's gravy. It's all gravy after that. So I teach these life lessons to kids, and they go back and tell their parents, hey, what you learn in hockey today? Well, coach made us all write a thing on humility. You know, and they're like, we wanted to go learn about a good wrister. Here he's coming home writing papers about humility for hockey. So I just got really good at teaching kids about life. Every kid that I ever taught and every kid I've ever coached will tell you my first lesson I teach every one of them is that you're all going to fall down. You know, I don't count how many times you fall down. You fall down 100 times. I don't count that. I count the 101 times you get up. That's all I count out there. And I said, that's how you do it in life. You get up in life. Always. You always get up in life. Hardest guy, and this is a great quote. I stole it from somebody else. So it's from the great Philadelphia philosopher, Rocky. A hard guy isn't how hard you can hit. It's how hard you can get hit and keep moving up, keep moving forward. That's a hard guy. That's the real hard guys in life. And so once you can do that, you can relay that message to people to get back up. Because I've not done nothing but get back up my life. So it all goes into my hockey now. It's the best thing I know. I know how to video coach. I worked for major teams. I worked for Anaheim. I worked for Dallas Stars. I worked with Philly. Again, let me go back to this. I'm a welfare kid from South Philadelphia who's now traveled the world and has worked for major hockey teams. And I love hockey. Always loved hockey. My favorite sport. Last story I could tell you on that is real quick. So I go for the job in Dallas, but their team was in Iowa, their farm team. So the president and all that was up in Iowa getting their farm team set up, and they were looking to hire people. They called me because they heard I was in Iowa. They said, hey, we'd like you to come in to talk about your hockey program. We think it'd be good for us. And I said, okay. So I go ahead and go have this meeting with these guys, the president of the team. And we're sitting there, and they're like, the guys love you. Everyone knows who you are. He goes, we want you to volunteer to do that. I said, volunteer? I got kids. Yeah, I ain't volunteering. You know, my wife ain't going to take that very well. So I said, I can't eat off hopes and dreams, dude. I need a job if I'm going to do this for you. President of the team says, look, we have two openings, one in grassroots marketing and the other in sponsorship, oil, you know, whatever. And I was like, I don't want the sponsor. I said, I'll take that grassroots marketing job, though. He reads it. He pulls out the paper. He goes, well, you have 2 years of college? No, I don't even have a college. I don't even have a high school diploma. He goes, okay, well, he goes, well, you don't fit any qualifications, Frank. You have to intern for 2 years. You have all these qualifications. He said, you don't fit any of these, Frank. You can't get the job. And I looked at him and said, dude, I used to get nerds to become Nazis. I think I get people to like hockey. And he goes, you're hired. And within 3 years, I was head of all marketing. Stuff like that, you know? Life's great.
Awesome, incredible story. Thank you for sharing that. If you didn't ever get caught with the aggravated assault and the kidnapping and you never went to prison, where do you think you'd be today? Where do you see yourself?
I'd probably be doing life on another case. I mean, if I didn't get caught then, I don't think there was no coming back. My line of caring about the human race and other human beings was very skewed at the time, and it was only getting more and more skewed. I mean, I had taken an oath to the movement at the time. It was basically a murderous oath, and I took it. And most of the people that took that oath with me are dead or in prison. So I mean, they all are. I'm like the one other. He's not. But there's, you know, whatever. The guys that were there that night are all dead or in prison. So that's where I'd be, because I was either going to be a martyr in my own head or, you know, just be, you know, sub-Oc G, Frank. You know? So that's where I'd be. There's no doubt. Prison or the grave.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to join us next week as we delve deeper into the general white supremacist movement with Frank and my colleague Kim Brown.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.